correct PDE to study is this fully nonlinear second order equation with Stratonovich calculus. So, if you like, with this extra hidden term there. Although I like to come back to the remark I made that after the question at the end of the lecture, for our theory, the fact that we have a Brownian motion is not an important thing. Think of it as a pathwise theory for any path of unbounded variations, and I will comment about that in this lecture. Okay. All right. Let me summarize here the main results as far as this PDE. So the goal is to introduce a notion of stochastic viscosity solution, so something that would allow us to define some kind of solution for this equation. Then we're going to I will show you a theorem that proves existence and uniqueness of solutions. I will drop in the sequence the X and omega dependence, and I will come back later on in the lectures and tell you what happens when we have explicit X dependence here. The only difference is statements become more complicated. So we're going to have an existence uniqueness theorem for F continuous, degenerate elliptic, and H continuous. There will be a theorem that tells you there exists a unique, almost sure viscosity solution. And I will start this thing in this lecture and finish it most probably tomorrow. All right, but before I go into that, I'd like to show to you some simple observations to at least to convince you that this is a non-trivial problem. Because so far I have claimed it's non-trivial, but I haven't given you any concrete indications about that. And the first remark I want to make has to do with the fact that the problem is non-trivial, and I want to explain that in this setting. Earlier, I wrote this down, stochastic D, let's put here Brownian motion, and I claim that if capital X was the solution of this ODE with initial data, let's say X, then after all, the solution to the stochastic PDE was nothing else but a rescaling of the autonomous problem, because the only randomness there is a multiplicative function of time. This is for this special problem. If I put an extra term there, then it doesn't hold, but I want to look at that. So one can look at the PDE and say, well, look, it's more or less the same situation. What you have is a multiplicative function of time there, so somehow you can change time scale and come up with an autonomous problem, solve the autonomous problem, and then go home, because there is nothing to worry about that. Okay, so let me explain that in this context. Forget about the epsilon. The epsilon there was left over from something else. So I want to consider now this equation, the u epsilon t equals h of the u epsilon zeta dot epsilon. Forget anything about randomness. Just assume that zeta epsilon dot is a smooth function, and as epsilon goes to zero, you can even ask it to change sign infinitely often, which will be the case if it were to converge to Brownian motion. And basically, formally, I would like to play the same game. So I would like to claim that I can solve the autonomous problem with capital U, and then denote the solution of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation as the capital U at the rescale time here, which will be zeta epsilon of t. And that looks okay, because if you take this formula and you just compute derivatives, you get a solution to the original problem. However, there is an issue here. The fact that zeta epsilon may change sign. Zeta epsilon t may be positive or negative, depending on how the derivative is initially. And so if it changes sign, And the autonomous equation does not have smooth solutions. And we know it won't have, because it's a Hamilton-Jacobi equation. We know in finite times we're going to have singularities. We're going to have shocks. And we cannot solve the forward-backwards problem. Then it's not true. It's false that this function is a solution to the original equation up there. There is nothing randomness here. There is no randomness here. Zeta epsilon is a nice, smooth function that changes sign. Then unless you have smooth forward-backward solution for this equation, this change of variables won't give you a solution to the original problem. Once more, nothing about randomness. This is now viscosity solutions, nothing else. You have shocks. The problem is you cannot go forward-backwards. Okay. So there is this observation. Let me make it even a bit more concrete and solve for you the answer to write down for you a formula for the only solution we have been able to compute explicitly. And this will be this example. Again, it looks like the PD I had in the previous lecture to explain, to denote the motion of front with normal velocity minus zeta dot epsilon. And for simplicity, I start with the initial data, which equals the length of x. Again, nothing random here. It's just a Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It turns out that the solution to that problem up there is this formula. It took maybe about 10 pages of computations to find the formula. Once you find the formula, then it's easy to go back and check immediately that is a solution. So it's one of these things. The reason it took us 10 pages of computation to do it is we had to look at all the intervals where zeta dot and zeta epsilon change the sign, apply Hopf's formula on every of these intervals, then put them together and realize that because of the special initial data we have, we could interchange, we could compute on any time interval explicitly the solution, put it together, and then do some induction argument to get this formula. Once you have the formula, then you can go back and do it, and then it's so 10 pages to find it, half a page to prove that this is a solution. And let's stare at this formula a little bit. There are some things that are artifacts of the choice of the initial data, which is the length of x. And this has to do with this positive part you see here. But I want you to stare a little bit at that. And again, for the experts in viscosity solutions, you will recognize that if zeta epsilon did not, zeta dot epsilon and zeta epsilon did not change sign, the correct solution of the problem will be this. This is the solution that you will have if the zeta epsilon and zeta dot epsilon did not change sign. But because it changes sign, you start building some memory, which has to do with this extra term here, which measures the negative part of zeta epsilon, the maximum of the negative part of zeta epsilon. I don't want you to read more in that formula than the fact that clearly this solution u epsilon there, it's not given in this by this form. That's the only reason I'm doing it. I'm writing it there. That clearly that function u epsilon there cannot be written in this form. Because there is this non-local term that comes in, which is the maximum minus zeta epsilon s. Okay? Now, if you want to let epsilon go to zero and assume that zeta epsilon goes to Brownian motion, you get this formula, which, after all, should be the solution to the problem with d b up there. So I claim, and we will prove that later, this is the viscosity solution of the problem with du epsilon du Stratonovich dB. You also see from this formula that whether the zeta epsilons go to Brownian motion or not, it's irrelevant. This now goes back to the comment I made earlier. In this formula, B of S, of B of T, can be any continuous function of time. So the fact that it's Brownian motion plays no role in passing to the limit here. Okay, and there goes my movie career. There goes that. Bob was much better with that, was not moving around so much. Okay. So I leave this thing up here as a, again, as the only example. Okay. However, this example, not so much the example, but the general question I posed earlier, raises the following question, which is to understand, in terms of the viscosity, at the level of the viscosity solution, the issue of the oscillations, the cancellations you have in time. So what's going on in this problem? Think again of the viscosity, think again of that problem up here. What was the problem to write it in this form? It was that, okay, you can go forward a little bit and then you want to go backwards. And I think Bob spent some time studying this issue of whether you can solve the problem forward and backwards. So you can go forward and then you want to go backwards, but you may have already passed the shock. And then you have a problem. And you want to continue figuring out what happens in this form, going forward and backwards. If you do it in a naive way, you don't get any real information. The reason is that the naive way is to just estimate in L1 how far you go ahead in time or not. That won't work if you are dealing with paths that have unbounded variation. So what you really need to do is to follow very carefully and see this cancellation. And the cancellation, you cannot see it in L1. Now, and again, I keep speaking here to the PDE audience. When we study PDE, when we learn PDEs, the course I have the fortune or misfortune, whatever, to learn it from Mike and have a very bad algebra teacher, so I had to keep one course, and that was PDE instead of algebra. Anyway, when we learn PDEs and we put a time dependence, an explicit time dependence on an evolution equation, the first thing we learn is assume that the time dependence is in some sense in an L1 form. And if all the assumptions you have to in time are integrable, there's no problem. Because you do what you need to do, and at some point the worst can happen is you have to integrate in time the estimates you get, and they work. And this is exactly what fails here. You cannot do all the estimates. And you cannot take absolute values, take the difference, putting in the absolute value of zeta dot epsilon, and then integrate it, because that's infinity. So if there is anything difficult here in this problem, is to deprogram yourself from this thing, this attitude we have, and go back and do everything from the beginning, thinking that you cannot integrate out the time. All right. So here is now a very simple fact which explains, gives you a way to measure this difference, these cancellations and oscillations you have in time. I take this problem. Let me assume that h is the difference of two convex functions. This is an assumption that's going to come up later, so I would like to show that in this case. Okay. So if h is the difference of two convex functions, here is a very sharp estimate you can obtain on the solution u of this equation. From above, you can bound it by solving the problem with H2 up to a time which is the maximum of the negative part. Then you apply, so this I should have put u naught here, and then you have the maximum with the other operator of the positive part. This is now in a very explicit estimate and ties together. You see a little bit how the maximum comes up here. Okay? Compare that to the typical estimate that we will get in PDEs. The typical estimate will be, okay, you want to know how big U is? Take absolute values here. So you have the problem with the absolute value of H, the length of H. Take length of zeta dot, and you write this as an estimate, which, of course, in the case of unbounded total variation will give nothing. So there is this very precise estimate you can have in the case where h is the difference of two convex functions. The proof is not complicated, and again, I will leave it like that, and maybe at the end of the lecture, if anybody wants to see it, I will explain it. it amounts to once more doing Hopf formula. But that leads to another question. And again, I apologize, all of a sudden probability disappeared. This looks a little bit esoteric. This looks more like fine properties of time-dependent Hamilton-Jacobi equations. A related question to everything I'm doing here is the following. Suppose we solve this epsilon problem. Again, zeta dot epsilon is some approximation to something. With an initial data x squared, the choice of x squared is to make the computations easier. And here I will ask the following question. I have the zeta epsilons, and let's assume I know that in any compact interval go to zero uniformly. But that's everything I know. And the zeta dot epsilons go to zero weakly, therefore. Is the following true? As epsilon goes to zero, the solution just goes to the initial data. Is that true or false? It's a very natural question, and of course it will be trivially true if you could have this representation. Because if you could have this representation here, and zeta epsilon goes to zero, you converge to the initial data. All right? But we claim we don't have it, so I'm asking now the question, when is it true that as epsilon goes to zero, you go to the initial data? And this is where this very surprising answer came up. So this question, the answer is true. So although the zeta dot epsilons go to zero weakly, the solution converges to the initial data if and only if h is the difference of two convex functions. One direction trivially comes from here. If h, there is a similar estimate from below where you interchange the S2, the H2 and the H1. If you are indeed in the case that h is the difference of two convex functions, zeta epsilon goes to zero means the positive part and the negative part will go to zero, and therefore you will converge to the initial data. So what is more interesting is that it's necessary and sufficient. Again, if time permits, I'll show you the proof of the other direction, because one direction is there. Now let's see now a little bit the interplay between the regularity of the path and the assumptions on H. If the paths were C1, and therefore in particular zeta dot of epsilon was going to zero strongly, there is nothing to worry about here. This is true from standard viscosity theory. So C1 paths is enough to have H continuous. Arbitrary paths, you need to have H to be the difference of two convex functions, because what I did not state correctly in the theorem up there is, if you want this to be true for any family of zeta epsilons going to zero, then it has to be the difference of two convex functions. If zeta is just Holder continuous with, zeta is Holder continuous with exponent and a half, you just need H Lipschitz. And therefore, if zeta was actually a Brownian motion, by an application of the law of large numbers, we can prove that also it's true for H Lipschitz. So in this statement, you see an interplay between the regularity.
You're saying if zeta epsilon go to zero with uniform bounds.
Okay. If I want to ask the question, when is it true that for any path zeta epsilon that goes to zero uniformly?
Yeah.
When is it true that u epsilon goes to zero, u naught? I say, okay, if h is the difference of two convex functions, it's obvious. And if I want that to be true for any family of paths, for an arbitrary class of all paths, then h has to be the difference of two convex functions.
Yeah.
However, if I'm willing to assume more regularity on the path,
but you got families of paths. Right?
Yeah, now if I'm willing to assume that these paths are not just arbitrary paths that go to zero and L infinity, but actually they are C half you can control
zero and L infinity with a bound in C a half.
Yes,
or they go
yes,
zero
yes,
C
with a bound in C a half. Then it's enough to have H to be Lipschitz. And in particular, Brownian motion, you can always Brownian motions are not really Hölder continuous with exponent and a half. It's a little bit less than a half, but there is always the law of large numbers that allow you to take care of that. And this is the only place in our theory where probability will play a role. When we have things for Hölder continuous with a half, then we can always do Brownian motion by doing the law of large numbers there. Okay. As I said, at the end of the lecture, I'll be happy to show the proof of that and the proof of this. So here you can even see that you may daydream that there is some kind of abstract interpolation going on, although the proof doesn't go like that. So you have C continuous difference of two convex functions, Lipschitz, and here you go from C1 down to C. Okay. Enough for that. Let's go now back to our PDE. And the first issue I want to study now is the issue, and the only reason I'm describing like that is that's how we would figure it out, is to understand the existence of solutions for this PD. So I want to carry out that program I described earlier. So I want to study the existence of solutions. And I haven't told you yet what the solution is, but I want to consider the following problem. Take any arbitrary, and I stand corrected for what I said earlier, there have to be continuous approximations to Brownian motion. I'm not doing something more complicated than that. So any continuous approximation to Brownian motion, and here I have a couple examples of how you can build such kind of approximations. One is you take a Brownian motion and you take a smooth convolution, or if you like, you do a very the simplest possible approximation you can have for the zeta dot. The other is that comes up with sophisticated probabilistic arguments is you can redo, you can take a fixed random function that has some mixing properties and you scale it. And that's one scaling. You can do a little bit different here. And the mixing conditions are written here. And again, way I see it is some way for the process for zeta to give you some independence near infinity. I'm not going to go further than that. We have enough experts who can explain what that means. And then you need some bound on the way that this thing becomes independent. All right. So this is irrelevant for me. It's just to show you one way to build smooth approximation to Brownian motion. Now I'm going to consider the approximate problem, which is I'm going to consider this family of evolution equations, and I, for future references, epsilon is to say that epsilon is the small parameter, zeta epsilon is what I put there in the initial data, and I am now in a situation where the viscosity theory applies, and for any fixed epsilon and u epsilon naught in the initial bounded uniformly continuous, assuming that I have the right assumptions on the joint dependence here, in particular continuity, I know there is a solution u epsilon. And the question I want to ask is whether the u epsilons have a limit as epsilon goes to zero, and if they do, what should be the equation for u? This is nothing else but the nonlinear version of this simple problem I stated in the second transparency, which was the only thing I'm doing here is I'm describing the nonlinear version of that. Everything nonlinear. So what happens as epsilon goes to zero? Okay, forget this statement about assumptions, and let me just state the theorem, and then we'll come back to the assumptions. So I take any two arbitrary approximations to the Brownian motion. Zeta epsilon and xi eta. Let's say zeta epsilon is this, and let's say xi eta is that. Solve, this is a P there, solve the initial value problems that corresponds to these two different, completely different approximations to the Brownian motion. Then the claim is that almost surely the difference of U epsilon and V eta goes to zero in L infinity. Two completely arbitrary approximations, the limit, the difference goes to zero in L infinity. In particular, for if U epsilon is Cauchy, and all, and therefore has a limit, and all approximations converge to the same limit. So this was the first result we got there, and we gave us some confidence that there is some room to do more in the problem. So again, any two solutions corresponding to any two arbitrary approximations to the Brownian motion, they go to the same limit. I won't be able to tell you anything more about the limit here, but that. Then we'll come back to the limit, to what is the limit. And here are the assumptions. I keep saying Brownian motion, but what I have in the back of my mind is arbitrary paths. So in that case, we have to assume that H is Lipschitz continuous and difference of two convex functions. F is continuous and degenerate elliptic. And the third assumption is an assumption that I have made here just to explain to you some of the ideas in the proof, which will motivate the definition of solution. It's not needed, and I have to say that because Mike is going to ask me in a minute whether I need this condition or not. It's an ongoing debate between the two of us. The third condition just says that in some sense you can complete the equation, and it means, for me, it says the following. I don't know. I don't want to explain what it means here. I'll show you in the proof. It's a condition that says that I can bound this difference by something else, which is also degenerate elliptic and has the property that when it's evaluated, the diagonal gives you zero. Let's not worry about that. It's some technical condition. I will leave it there, and it's not needed. It's there only to explain to you the idea of the proof and the idea of the definition.
For every lambda, for every A...
Okay, I mean, if you write down the uniqueness proof without the lemma, this is the condition you always use. Okay. So the only difference in the uniqueness proof without the lemma is that you put it for the identity, and I want to have it for any matrix A. But it's nothing changes, the same condition. Okay. Now here comes... For the non-viscosity people at the audience, a crass course in the uniqueness proof. And maybe, what is that? How long was it? 83 to 91? So, and also 8 years of attempts to solve, to do that. All right. So a possible strategy, if you want to show that this difference goes to zero, is to write down the equation satisfied by the difference and somehow show that that equation, the solution of the equation satisfied by the difference can be bounded from above and below by something that goes to zero, and therefore you are done. I mean, that's the uniqueness proof for viscosity solutions. Remember, nothing is smooth here. The U epsilon and the V eta are not smooth. They are just the best you can hope they are is bounded uniformly continuous functions. Remember, we're in the context of viscosity solutions. They are not smooth solutions. I will write down things here as if they were smooth, but then one has to go back and justify them, and I will tell you where is the main point. All right, so let's call zeta of xyt the difference of two solutions. And I have to double, I don't know, I'm trying to sell this thing to the probabilist in the audience, so... The experts don't pay attention to that. Because you have to deal with non-smooth solutions, the only way you can deal with that is to double the variables. So you don't know that U epsilon and V8 are smooth. So what you try to do is double the variables and then try to show that you can do something around the equation with double variables. Okay, whatever that means. okay. So you double that. and you write down the equation for zeta t. Everything is formal because viscosity solutions don't allow you to do that in this formal way. But formally, you subtract the two equations, and then you rewrite, and this is in this line here, the equation satisfied by z, where I have rewritten everything as a functions now as derivatives of the z function. Okay?
It's showing the x and the y, where we talked about the one variable.
Okay, the x is here and the y is there. What do we want to show more than that? And
well, just pause on it for a second.
Okay. All right. So let me show to you what I've done here. So let's say you were solving the heat equation, just to see what I've done here. And let's say V was solving also the heat equation. So, and let's forget you have smooth solutions. So I wrote u of xt, or take you have smooth solutions, but let's write it down in the difference. Call that z of xyt. And the only thing I did there is I said that zt is equal Laplacian of x of u plus Laplacian with respect to y of v. I just subtracted two things. And therefore, if I rewrite that, if I rewrite that, in terms of z, what I have is Laplacian x with respect to z. Where did I make a mistake with the minus? Subtract this. Yeah.
You need a minus.
Here. I have a minus somewhere.
You got a minus there. Yeah.
Here? Okay, if you say so, that's even better. Okay, so I came down to that. Now, the next step that I have there with red is to say that since I have a function which is of separated variables, not only satisfies this equation, but it also satisfies this equation where I add the mixed derivatives. This is zero if this is smooth. This is my operator g. This is the function g up there. So that's what I meant, I complete the Laplacian. Of course, nothing is smooth here. And therefore, that step that is so easily seen down there, it took about 8 years to justify, and very nice ideas by Bob. So there is an 8-year gap between the proof of uniqueness for viscous solutions for first-order equations and the proof of uniqueness for viscosity solutions to second-order equation. And one way to say is it took 8 years to do this. The proof of Bob is not like that, actually. It's difficult to see what... a little bit, but it's it's this. All right. Having said that, let me write down this line and say, okay, I write down the difference. And because of the assumption I have there, z is a subsolution to this equation. Where you notice I bounded the difference of f minus f by that condition up there, by the g that looks like that. Okay. Now here comes the next fact in the proof of uniqueness for viscosity, the next trick, which is the following. I write down the equation satisfied by the difference with the double variables. If now for that equation I can find an appropriate super solution that has the property that when x is equal to y is zero, then I'm done. Because if, especially if it is a nice smooth super solution, because z will be less equal that nice super solution. And if this nice super solution has the property that when x equals y is 0, then at least u will be less equal v when x equals y. So that's the whole idea of doubling the variables. So in this case, let's choose this super solution, where, of course, my constant here will depend on epsilon eta, because remember, I still have these two extra terms here to deal with. If you like, at the first passage, just to understand the proof, forget these two terms. Then that will be some constant. Then you check whether this is a super solution to the z equation. You compute the second derivatives of that, And you see that G there is zero because the second derivatives are just the identity matrix. And my assumption was on the capital G function that if I plug in the identity matrix here, up there, I get zero. So when I plug here x minus y squared, that is zero. It's the same reason, look at this level. That's why you needed to complete this equation. If I put z in this equation, x minus y squared, I won't get zero. If I put in this equation x minus y squared, I get exactly zero. And that's the purpose of doubling the thing. Okay, so that's zero. These two arguments are the same because of the symmetry properties of x minus y. And everything I'm left is this constant minus this function h of lambda x minus y zeta dot epsilon minus xi dot eta. Note, by the way, if I didn't have these functions of times, that won't be there, so I will have immediately the right upper bound. Okay, let me assume for the sake of this false proof that h is bounded. I can assume anything I want here. This proof is not going to work. H is bounded. And let's assume that I knew that the difference zeta dot epsilon minus psi dot eta goes to zero uniformly. Now, you know this is false because the zeta, epsilon, the xi, eta just converge to Brownian motion. I know nothing about the derivatives. But let's assume I knew something. Then I could choose the constant C epsilon also going to zero. I could choose the constant C epsilon to bound that and also going to zero as epsilon eta goes to zero. Then I have a nice super solution. So I have z of xyt less equal lambda x minus y squared plus that plus the L infinity norm at time t equals zero. And then you play the game. This thing goes to zero as lambda goes to infinity and epsilon eta go to zero because the assumption was that in L infinity this difference goes to zero, and sending lambda going to infinity forces x and y to go, x to go to y. So that's a technical statement. This way you get that u epsilon is less equal to v eta. This is the typical proof for uniqueness modified to serve my purposes for this. And you know I'm hiding steps, so nobody should take this as the real proof of the uniqueness, but that's the essence of it. And although I make it to look like I really need this condition, I don't need it. It's okay. However, there's a big problem, which is that I don't have it, I won't have it in our case. So you look at that and you realize that this proof is not going to do anything for you because there is no way you're going to make this thing to go to zero, no matter how hard you work, because it doesn't. Okay, so here's a decision time. I either take 15 minutes or I stop now and I start with this. It's up to you. You are there.
Yeah.
Yes.
I would say you need take 15 minutes.
Okay. All right. All right, this is an aside comment right now, a side thing. I need to build up the punchline. So let's look at that. Forget about the proof. I know it's a little bit anticlimactic at this point to ask you to forget that. But let's now consider stochastic Hamilton-Jacobi equations. Forget the F, forget all this fancy stuff. And let's think of small-time solutions of this problem.
I don't understand. You were trying to explain that all limits were the same?
Yeah.
And you're still in the progress of
that? Yeah, I am. But I have to show it to you how I'm going to take care of that. And that will take a couple of transparencies to show you how I'm going to take care of that. That will also explain to you what will be the definition of the solution. All right. And to do that, I have to introduce some notation, if nothing else. So stochastic Hamilton-Jacobi equations, let's assume that H is C3, it's irrelevant. I mean, you can do it with a difference of two convex functions, but let's take it to be C3 now, so I can write down things. Let's take phi to be C3 and consider this very simple stochastic Hamilton-Jacobi equation. I claim that the method of characteristics gives us a small time, random small time, almost sure smooth solutions, which I denote by S, the semigroup S starting at T and going up to time S. For a difference S minus T small, how small, it's random, I have a solution given by characteristics. As a matter of fact, if I write down the characteristics corresponding to that equation, they're here. They're exactly there, so you can solve them explicitly. You see whether I have a Brownian motion or I don't have a Brownian motion is irrelevant, because that's the formula. The only thing you see is the BS minus BT, and that could be any function. Then you write down the Jacobian, and you figure out that there is some random time such that you can invert the characteristics. And once you invert them in this interval, this is the solution. Okay? And in the case of the Brownian motion, you can just go ahead by brute force, apply Itô's formula, and see that you really build a solution to that problem. And this is a short time, smooth in X, but not, of course, in time, solution to the stochastic Hamilton Jacobi equation there. So the punchline of all that is, if I have H smooth, and difference of two convex functions smooth enough in this case, but then it's more complicated to write it. The method of characteristics give me, for any smooth phi, a local time, smooth in X, solutions to the stochastic Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Okay. Maybe it's three transparencies, but we'll do it. All right, now back to the sketch of the proof. Then I should leave the sketch of the proof here. All right. Some additional notation, and then we're done. S epsilon eta of phi will be the smooth solution in this random time interval of the doubled Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Recall, it's a solution of that equation. Drop this and that. That's the double Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Okay, it's up here. This part. Forget that. So for any phi smooth, the previous transparency convinced you that there is a short time smooth solution to that Hamilton, double Hamilton-Jacobi equation. There is also a small time smooth solution to this problem with dB. Again, it's the previous transparency. Everything is small time. Random small time. It's nothing else but just if you want, just staring at this formula that S epsilon of H goes to S because this is a short time smooth solution given by that. This is a short-time smooth solution given by this, but now it will have epsilons inside and etas, and everything goes to formula goes to formula. I'm not saying anything else. Formula goes to formula. I'm at the situation where everything is smooth. So this goes to that. Nothing more than that. Now let's repeat this argument with our favorite test function, which is lambda x minus y squared. Then it's not difficult to see that the best solution you can have for this problem is lambda x minus y squared, because when you plug in x minus y squared here, this kills that. So the solution of this problem with initial data lambda x minus squared is lambda x minus y squared. It doesn't change. Just plug it in. And because of this statement, when you plug this thing in, the S epsilon S of t lambda x minus y squared, this will converge to lambda x minus y squared. Okay. Fine. And now we can finish. What did I do with the extra? Okay, I'm here. Sorry for that. And so the way to cure this incurable problem is to say, at that level, instead of using this test function, I will use this test function. This is a nice, smooth in X function It depends symmetrically on x minus y squared. So when if I use this as a test function up there, remember, there's nothing random about that. This is a good solution, I mean, of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, a good smooth in x solution of that. If I plug it into there, the second derivative, because this is a function of x minus y squared, will kill the g. And this is also going to get killed because this is an exact solution to that problem. That's how I chose it. So by choosing the appropriate test function, I just kill the term I couldn't control before. And then the proof goes as before. Because after all, this test function is not far away from the actual test function, the x minus y squared at the limit, and so I can obtain the bound I want in the end. Okay? Looks like a nice trick. It works. But there is an idea behind it. And the idea behind it is that, and which we will use to give a definition for the solution, is that instead of using arbitrary test functions as we do for viscous solutions, we're going to use test functions which are short-time smooth solutions of the Hamilton-Jacobi part of the equation. Now, and basically, and then I will quit here, and I will try to start again somehow through the middle of this proof tomorrow. The idea here is this. We are interested in solving this problem. Let's make it simple. This is the problem we want to solve. And what we do is we rewrite it this way. Now it's related to your question earlier about martingales and what we really do here. And somehow, by using the appropriate test functions, is we introduce a function v, which has the property that vt is du minus hdu dot db. And doing that, we reduce the original problem to solving vt equals f d square v. But there is a fundamental difficulty with that. That the solution u is non-smooth. And therefore, to do that, we have to do it at the level of the test functions. Doing it at the level of the test functions destroys the flexibility that we have in viscosity solutions to plug anything that looks like nice and get estimates. So you cannot get any more estimates. The only thing you can get is precise things that kill the random thing, the random term. And to do that, again, creates tremendous technical difficulties because you cannot have errors. Everything has to be exact. Okay, now, I apologize for this proof. This lecture was technical. I want to show you the idea of the existence proof. I will start with these observations tomorrow and try to motivate the definition of the solution and also explain to you why this is more or less the correct way of defining the solution. Okay, so I'll stop here.
Any further questions? No, we break the alarm.
Thanks. We have those equivalences that C1 was first called into the continuousness, the ones C1 was not as well.
Yeah, I think it's general. It's general. Yeah, it's general. It only amounts to having more or less the idea. There is the following: if I have a prescribed regularity on the zetas, then I can regularize them in such a way that I preserve the prescribed regularity in a uniform way. So if this is C alpha, then I have an error here, which is like n to the minus alpha, whatever it is. And then when I have a Hamiltonian H, which has the corresponding and has to be the conjugate regularity, then I approximate that with an HN, where I can make the right error here, which will be what it should be, and also be able to control the second derivative of that, so I can control the length of existence of that. So I can adjust everything. The thing that you miss there is if you do Brownian motion, because you are never, I mean, you have to use the exact modulus of continuity, and that's where you have to do a repeated law, the law of large number time of argument, and then you can take care of the logarithmic term you have there. Yeah, but that's general.
No, we're very